newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.
The Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we talk about what's going on in newsrooms, what the latest trends are in news coverage, and how reporters are bearing up under the pressures of the new journalism ecosystem. We invite you to join us. I'm Rex Smith, formerly editor of the Times Union, now creating the Upstate American on Substack, and I'm here with two colleagues, the former editor of the Daily Gazette, Judy Patrick, and the former executive editor of the Saratogian, and the Record of Troy, that would be Barbara Lombardo. Judy Patrick, what's in your mind today?
You know, President Trump's treatment of the press seemed to have hit rock bottom, and sometimes I worry about how much lower can this guy go?
What do you think, Barbara? What's in your mind?
I hope that's not a dare. What I want to know is not just how low he can go, but what the press is supposed to be doing about it.
Yeah. All of that is really appropriate, I think. And we try to not have this program be only about Donald Trump because there is an awful lot of commentary about it. But in point of fact, the president is defining the culture and the attack on journalism for the society in many ways. And it has a great effect on everybody because we see so many local politicians, in effect, aping the president and deciding that if he can do this, we can too. So just to review exactly what happened in the Oval Office when the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was visiting, the president assailed an ABC News reporter, a reporter named Mary Bruce, the White House correspondent, because she had the temerity to ask about Jamal Khashoggi, who was murdered, our intelligence sources say, upon orders specifically of MBS, the Crown Prince. And earlier, actually, he had taken issue with a reporter for Bloomberg News, cut her off when she tried to ask about the Epstein files. He said, "Quiet, piggy." And so you wonder, what are the implications of this kind of A, denigration of the press, and B, an attack on the whole notion of truth-telling and asking tough questions?
So, first of all, these personal attacks are so beneath the office of the president as to be astounding. They were uttered by a man who has been elected to lead our nation. Personal attacks aside, he's attacking every single reporter in that room and also, by inference, the organizations they represent. Because we're also, at the same time, we're also seeing Brendan Carr, the head of the FCC, Truth Social tweets or posts indicate that maybe, you know, ABC, for whom this reporter worked, their license should be looked at. The whole ecosystem is being so dramatically attacked that we really need to stand up. You know, Ken Tingley in his Substack column mentioned that a better question from the ABC News reporter to the prince would have been, could you please tell us where you put the parts of Jamal Khashoggi and return them so his family can give him a proper burial? I mean, that might have been, I mean, I think that's a legitimate question as well. It might have gone a little too far. Maybe Trump could have objected to that. The one that she made was entirely polite.
It was entirely appropriate. What else would you ask when you have a visit by the Crown Prince, a pariah, and just a few years ago, somebody who the president of the United States wouldn't, the previous president, would not meet with because he had murdered a journalist working for an American organization, a legal resident of the state of Virginia. But now we're not supposed to even ask about it?
We must ask about it. And I think that the media's got to wake up and act as a group and not as individuals who are going to just take this guff, take these insults from the president of the United States. An insult to one reporter is an insult to every reporter in the room, to every American, to the whole system of our democracy, to freedom of speech. And he's modeling behavior that should not go ignored. So when a reporter is called piggy, and I had hoped that originally that maybe he misspoke or maybe we misheard.
You're trying to say picky? He thought she was being too picky?
Something. I had hoped that it was misheard by the reporters, but it was apparently not misheard. that the press corps has to stand up as a group representing their specific organizations and just say, that's not the way to speak to a member of our press corps.
Yeah, somebody in the gaggle.
We demand.
Yeah, should have said, hey, that's impolite.
Yeah, I guess you can't demand him, but that's unacceptable. Mr. President, the next person who's called on, Mr. President, or they all stand up, Mr. President, that sort of language is unacceptable.
Why doesn't somebody do that in the White House press corps? You know, in the Pentagon, when the Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, that's not his title under statute, of course, but when he decided that he was going to require a sort of loyalty oath from reporters, everybody declined to sign it. And therefore, the official Pentagon press corps is now a bunch of right-wing influencers and the president's pal, Laura Loomer, accredited to cover the Pentagon. So why doesn't that happen at the White House?
But I see two reasons. One is the ownership. Who are these people working for? And their concern about, you know, what repercussions are going to come business-wise for them if they do that. And I think the other thing is the ingrained notion that we're supposed to, we as the reporters asking questions, that we're supposed to take that crap from whoever's dishing it out and rise above it and ignore it and just try to, in an even-handed way, continue our job. That's got to be rethought.
I think that you're right about the notion, the concern about the ownership, about the establishment of journalism, that we do know that major media outlets are owned by people who are increasingly kowtowing to the president. Look at Jeff Bezos, the owner of the Washington Post, and how much he is now trying to be a pal of Donald Trump. Would he tolerate a Washington Post reporter who was willing to stand up to the president this way? And aren't there just more reporters who are going to stand in line ready to take the space of these reporters who might be willing to stand up as a group?
We talk about reporters standing up, but their bosses need to stand up too. Their editors, the president of ABC News should have made a call to the White House the next day and complained about the treatment of his reporter. I mean, reporters are employees that need to be taken care of just as any other employee at any other company. You know, Trump is particularly nasty to people when he doesn't like the question, but also to women. I mean, he has been critical of male reporters as well, but the nastiest comments tend to come to women. In these cases, both women calling the one from Bloomberg Miss Piggy, often telling reporters that they're stupid, that they're lazy, they work for a bad network, all not true. And these kind of things trickle down. And so it enables the secretaries in his cabinet to also treat reporters with this kind of disdain. It enables or allows people at the state levels or at the county levels, and even the average person. I saw a discussion on social media where they were coming down in favor of Trump's treatment of the reporter, and how dare she ask the Saudi prince this question. It's like, this is a question. This is what the press is there for. These kinds of questions need to be posed to these guys, because back in their home country, if you ask this kind of question, you go to jail.
And I guess the fear is that that would happen in this country, but I think you're right. We all, as newsroom leaders, have had occasion on a much less consequential scale to have to stand up for our reporters when they've been criticized by public officials, by people saying, well, that was inappropriate. We have had these experiences, all of us, in leading our newsrooms. On the level of ABC News or the level of Bloomberg News, there needs to be pushback, and there will be some financial consequences for these companies, because with President Trump saying ABC's broadcast license ought to be revoked because White House correspondent Mary Bruce asked a tough question, ABC may therefore have to fight the FCC in order to keep its affiliates licensed. And ABC has to be willing to take that. If you are going to own and derive profit from your business dealings, from your journalism, you have to be willing to do the job.
Can you just imagine this, that the president of the United States is threatening to revoke the broadcast license of a station because he did not like the question asked? I mean, we are in new territory. Well, we've been in this territory for a while, but this is unheard of. This is wrong. This needs to be addressed. And the people who run major news organizations need to step up as a group.
It seems to me that it is now incumbent upon the journalists, the rank-and-file journalists, to try to strengthen the spine of their owners. If the owners themselves can't do it, the individual journalists need to demand it. And it may require collective action by journalism organizations to force owners to have a conscience, because this is clearly a very difficult time for American democracy, and you can't have the pose of being independent and not being concerned about this.
The Society of Professional Journalists Code of Ethics, which I'm in the midst of looking at case studies and examining that foundation with my students at UAlbany, and maybe we need something added to that, because that's all focused on the behavior of the media in an attempt to be fair, to minimize harm, to report the truth, to be transparent, to be accountable for what we're doing. And there's more to that of how to act when they're being denigrated, when they're being threatened, when their ability to do their job is literally being threatened.
Well, doesn't it go to the question of what journalism is like in this era? Doesn't go to the question of what kind of journalism we need in this era. We have been looking at an interview in Columbia Journalism Review with the editor-in-chief of Guardian US, whose name is Betsy Reed. And she talks about the danger in journalism of the normalization of extremism in covering the White House. But I wonder if she doesn't have an advantage because the Guardian has been, since its founding in the 1930s, unabashedly liberal in its outlook. And news organizations in America traditionally have not had an intentional bias, at least over the last half century. And so the question is, if you can kind of split that, if you can be an organization that tries to speak to the whole country the way ABC, NBC, CBS, The New York Times, and so on do, and yet still stand up against a president who is taking an axe to freedom of the press in this country.
It's a great stop for me every morning to go to The Guardian and see what they're reporting. And even though, you know, you may say they have a liberal bias, I think the reporting is typically strong, solid, and innovative. They're telling me things that I don't know, and they're offering a kind of broad perspective and context that you often don't get if you follow just the mainstream big news organizations in the U.S.
So their admitted liberal and progressive values are maybe not reflected in how they cover the stories, but they are going to be reflected in the decisions that they make about what to cover and what to emphasize. And I think that more news outlets need to do the same, although I'm worried about how that's going to translate at a place like the Washington Post.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting question. The Guardian actually appeals for donations. You know, you see that all the time when you're on the side of Guardian US. Last year, they brought in $43 million, about $50 million, they say, this year, 400,000 recurring supporters, which was a lot more than it was. So they're growing, in other words.
And I spontaneously donated one day because they're saying very clearly we're not going to have a paywall, but we depend on contributions. So what do you think? And I was so impressed. I've been so impressed with the reporting. Can I give one example that Betsy Reed offered that I think could inform a way to cover this extremism, the normalization of extremism? And she had mentioned in the interview that on the morning of one of the recent No Kings protests, The New York Times led its website with a story about George Santos receiving a pardon, while The Guardian had the whole day devoted to the No Kings protest. And that was what was affecting more people across the country than this one. You know, people know who George Santos is. Maybe they're going to want to hear about it. It's certainly news that that happened. But you're out of touch when you're covering that at the expense of what's happening all over the country. And I would extend that to say that the protests against ICE that are happening all over the country should be covered every day. And the arrests by ICE need to be covered every day. We need to keep reminding people that this is happening rather than, well, it's not news anymore. That's how you're a frog in a pot of boiling water.
Right. What a perfect example, Barb. And it's almost the inside the beltway kind of approach to news. And you've got people who live, work, and so they're going to chase the latest thing. And that's the problem. They are not getting out into the country and doing this kind of reporting. They're touching upon it, but it's easier for them to make the call to their regular sources and get a comment from or drag some politician into the studio and do that and do, you know, a simple interview. So again, the inside the beltway, they don't understand what the country really cares about.
And what it really needs to be caring about as well. I think it really requires the decision makers in newsrooms to have some very hard conversations with themselves about what is important for people to know in the context of American political life these days. And it's going to tick off some readers. It's going to turn people away. But if you get into this business of journalism, you're supposed to be courageous.
You know, I'm facing a challenge with that on the college level. I'm not particularly involved in the school newspaper, but I occasionally will talk to a couple of the editors, and they routinely will cover what I would call boring student association meetings as if that is their main job. And I don't know how many of the student body members are actually reading those stories instead of focusing on the issues. And that requires maybe looking at the issues that the student association is addressing and also just talking to lots of students. What are the issues that they ought to be covering?
This is actually something that we all have encountered as reporters and as editors, and that is the easy stories to cover are those that just set themselves up for you. And you hear it all the time on the radio, you see it on TV, you see it in print. Somebody voices a press release on a radio newscast. Somebody rewrites a press release and puts it into print. And that's not journalism, it is stenography. And we need to be asserting the use of reporters and their skills for reporting that makes a difference, that really speaks to people's lives. It's harder, it takes more time to do, but it really can matter. And that's what will draw listeners and viewers and readers, as opposed to the kind of stuff that we all engaged in. We all made this mistake as reporters. When I was a reporter in the state capitol, I would think, oh, I've got to go cover this press conference. Well, you probably don't. You can probably write a better story without going to the press conference.
Right. We used to call them dog and pony shows when you would have a politician going around the state promoting a bond act or some other kind of initiative. You go and you cover it and everybody else would cover it. I mean, why did 10 of us, you know, 10 different outlets cover the same press conference, write the same story? It was a waste of resources. When I look back at the things we wasted time and talent on over the years, we could have been doing so much more. But again, it's harder to write the stories that don't come out of the press conferences. We used to say, go to the press conference, but write something else, something out of it. But when you're trying to fill a newspaper up and the reporter is faced with writing three stories a day, you've got to empathize with them trying to generate that much content.
Well, here's a great example, actually, that is just perfect from North Carolina, which we read about from pointer.org. There's a little subscriber-supported newsletter launched in 2021 called The Food Section. It's written by someone named Hannah Raskin, who used to be the food editor and chief critic for the Post and Courier in Charleston, South Carolina. Fine newspaper that has fallen on hard times, as a lot of newspapers have. So she left the newspaper and started this newsletter and decided that, you know, there's a weird thing going on out there. In North Carolina, all distilled spirits are sold only through stores that are owned and operated by the state. There are several states that are like this, where they regulate the retail sales of alcohol. And so she decided, there's a weird thing. The state is not doing a good job of inventory, of basically pricing and distributing the spirits that people want to have. Now, you may think, well, this is not such a big deal, but if you're a journalist focusing on food and drink, you might care about whether you can get a particular liquor or liqueur or some distilled spirit. And so she actually filed 171 records requests, and she went to 70 stores as a secret shopper and found out where the state was doing a bad job of providing alcohol to the consumers. And I imagine that really mattered to consumers in North Carolina.
And did she go on to explain why that product was absent?
Ah, because the state had decided that it didn't need to stock it there?
Right. And she introduced me to a kind of liquor that I, being the hick that I am, I've never heard of. Amaro?
Amaro.
I had never heard of it.
Right.
And, you know, for some reason, though, she felt a need to go undercover to do this. I would have just gone into the store and say, hey, do you have any of this? But she did this, you know, pretending that she was, I don't understand the reason to be undercover about it. I like the idea that she went to all of them and found out that some of them carried this obscure liquor. We'll probably hear that it's really important liquor that I've been missing on my whole life.
It's got to be to somebody's financial benefit that they are not purchasing this. You know, there's got to be more to that story. I think that going undercover was important because once one person knows in the business knows that there's a reporter poking around, then they're going to be all talking to each other, and then they're either going to suddenly find a, you know, dust off a bottle of it or put it on their shelves. Or I think to keep it a pure research project, she needed to not identify herself at the start.
There's always been controversy about whether reporters need to identify themselves. And, you know, our ethical standards say you do. And I've made that mistake as a reporter, failing to say who I am and then using a quote that I would get. And you think, well, what's the big deal?
Well, that was wrong.
Yeah, that was wrong.
Tisk, tisk, tisk. But in popular culture, you see reporters going undercover all the time. So people are under the impression that that is what we do. I would concede that sometimes that's a good way to get a story, but that is not the ethical way from my career how to do it.
So I think that what you would add to, say, in the case of this liquor store expose, that after you've got your information, then you go back to the owners and saying, I'm so-and-so with whatever outlet or independent journalist, and I'm going to be publishing a story about blah, 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 and then giving them a chance to respond, knowing that their response is going to be on the record. On the other hand, what they tell you, not knowing that it's going to be broadcast to a greater audience than the two of you, why shouldn't they be held accountable for that as well?
You know, as a reporter, I used to hate having to walk around covering an event with a tag around my neck identifying me as a reporter. It was like standing out a flashing light, don't go near this person. But oftentimes, places like the track in Saratoga would require you to walk around with these tags. And I hated that.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you'd hate it more now when you're a target for
being called
danger.
Piggy.
Yeah, absolutely. Folks, if you'd like to share your thoughts, media@wamc.org is how you connect with us, and we'd always love to hear your thoughts. That piece, what we're talking about really goes to, Barbara, you were discussing the Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists, which you're speaking to your students at UAlbany about. That goes to the tenet that says, act independently, be transparent, actually, is what that one is. We're supposed to be able to be transparent in our news gathering and to be able to step forward to the people we are serving, the readers, listeners, viewers, and say, this is how we got this story, believing that that transparency is essential for credibility. And I don't know that that's always proven out. People seem these days to believe journalism based upon whether they agree with it or not. And that has been one of the bad products of this hyperpartisan age, where people are only consuming information from people they know they agree with. And we get influencers now taking the place of reporters in the Pentagon, as we were saying before. And you find that people don't really know how stories are shaped. And they seem to not care if there are ethical breaches, if it nevertheless redounds to the benefit of their favorite politicians.
And they also don't know what they're not being told by the outlets that they like to use for consuming their news. And it happened the other morning when there were, before the House had the Epstein release vote, there was a big news conference with lots of the victims of Epstein speaking and showing pictures of them when they were 14 or 16 and telling their story. When you flip to Fox News, it was about the Charlotte's terrible behavior in the face of ICE trying to help them out. There was nothing about the Epstein press conference with all the victims. Even Marjorie Taylor Greene was there, and they didn't cover it.
It becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy if people say this story is important because Fox News is covering it and the Fox News audience turns to it because that's what they're being fed. It becomes more of a story because Fox News makes it that way. It is a distortion of reality.
And it's a conscious decision, clearly, on the part of every news organization, but in this case, especially Fox.
Well, that's all we have time for in this week's edition of the Media Project. We're hoping, by the way, this is pre-Thanksgiving. Hope you all have a great holiday. We'll be back next week's show with the different Lombardo, David, the son of. What do you think about that? Is that okay, have the son take the seat?
Yeah, I made him.
Well, we're thankful for him.
Nice job, Barb. Good work. The Media Project, Barbara Lombardo, Judy Patrick, and I'm Rex Smith. David Gustina is the producer of The Media Project. We thank you all for joining us. Hope you come back again next week and the week after for The Media Project.
Startled poor old Sadie's on ting-a-ling-a-ling city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling, ling. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. when they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her...
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, former vice president for editorial development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustino. Thanks for listening.
Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.